Welcome. Thank you for tuning in to Seattle Veterans for Peace Radio Hour. Veterans for Peace is a global organization of military veterans and allies. Always the goal is to change public opinion in the U.S. from an unsustainable culture of militarism and commercialism to one of peace, democracy, and sustainability. We do this primarily, although not exclusively, through grassroots organizing and education at the local level. Through individualized chapter actions and national campaigns, Veterans for Peace sharpens awareness about the true costs of war and serves as an advocate for peace as a national policy. This is a Seattle-based monthly podcast broadcast where veterans will share information, experiences about military service and the ongoing struggle against militarism and war. I'm Aurora Child. I'm an Iraq, Afghanistan era veteran and a member of Veterans for Peace. Today, I'm here with Michael McPherson. How's it going, Michael?
All right. Hello, everyone. Thanks for listening. Wow. It's 2020. I mean, it's crazy. Happy New Year, and may everyone have a prosperous decade. I'm Michael McPherson. I'm an Army veteran, member of Veterans for Peace. I'm excited that this is our chapter's third radio show. Today, we have two out-of-studio interviews. Aurora, you interviewed the president, the local president of Veterans for Peace, right?
I did. Phoenix Johnson is our president here at the local chapter, and we talked a little bit about their history joining the military and how they ended up at Veterans for Peace.
Right, right. And it's a very good interview. I want to say real quick that Phoenix, highly respect her. She's been helping me. You know, I moved here a little while ago, about 6 months ago, and she's getting me used to Seattle and introducing me to people. I really respect her. I spoke to Faraz Azad, who's a friend of mine, about the conflict between Iran and the U.S. As you know, the U.S. government killed Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, setting up the potential for a shooting war between the two nations. Faraz and I talked about the long-term conflict between Iran and the U.S. Faraz Azad is an American-Iranian living in the U.S. He's a really good friend of mine I've known for some time now. He served in the Iranian Air Force from 1971 to 1973. He is the chair of the VFP's, that's Veterans for Peace, Iranian Working Group, and executive secretary of the U.S. Peace Council. So let's get right to the interviews.
Phoenix Johnson, the president of Seattle Chapter 92 Veterans for Peace, and we're going to talk a little bit about their history with the military and how they came into Veterans for Peace. Hello, Phoenix.
Hey, Aurora. Thanks for having me today.
Thanks for coming. Can you tell us a little bit about your military history and what sort of was going on in your mind when you were joining the military and how that began for you?
Yeah, for sure. So just a quick overview of my military service is I served active duty in the Air Force from 03 to 07. I left 90 days after the Iraq invasion. however, I was actually in the delayed enlistment program. So as a high school student, before I was even legally an adult, I was enlisted in the military, and having regular monthly contact and even weekly contact with my military recruiter, where I had taken my ASVAB test at 16 years old.
Where did you enlist out of?
I was currently living outside of Portland in a small town called Cascade Locks in the Columbia Gorge.
Is that where you grew up?
I am a military brat, actually. So that means that one of my parents served and was active duty in the Coast Guard as a career and retired 20 years into it. So a lot of my time was spent on waters where the Coast Guard was serving, specifically for search and rescue missions, and as a quartermaster on the Coast Guard cutters in the waters of Alaska and Oregon, but also out in the Great Lakes.
Cool. That's interesting. So that probably had a little bit of influence on your decision.
Yeah, definitely did. My father served, but so did my uncle and several, my brother-in-law and my cousin. So I think we had basically every branch of service within my different families, and definitely grew up on military bases with aircraft overhead and visiting different bases, you know, when we went on vacation like that. That was definitely just, we had a very militaristic life.
So it was just like normal, and you probably didn't question it too much.
No, I really didn't. I didn't question it at all. It was even actually put more so on a pedestal. Like enlisting into the military was kind of meeting the top standards of what it was to be an American, what it was to be patriotic, and to really achieve like a respectable high status life.
Now, I know you a little bit personally, and I know that our viewers might not, but I just wanted to talk a little bit about your family history and your Indigenous and what that might have to do with like your military service. Or do you think that there was like extra pressure, or do you feel that you were maybe even targeted more?
I feel like there is a really high relationship between like myself, my Indigenous identity, like as a person. I feel that, you know, statistically there are the most per capita that serve from the Native population, from the First Nations population in the military. So that's actually been, that's been a topic that's been, you know, examined in a way where there's a lot of different answers for that. And so people who are First Nations already have this tie to the land and this obligation to want to protect the land and be stewards of the land. But on the other hand, also, you know, something that Veterans for Peace educates about is the, you know, how we use different methodologies to recruit folks, or not methodologies, but I guess tools or even weapons, right? And is really targeting folks who have been oppressed via economically disadvantaged, or experiencing like gender oppression or racial oppression in a way where it feels like we are buckled into a position and then fed this, this thing that we think will meet our needs, and maybe it does in some sense, but via a very manipulative, exploitative way.
Mm-hmm. All right, so back to your enlisting and everything. Tell me how that went, and what was that like for you, just the beginning and...
The very beginning, right, being born in Seattle, my father was on an icebreaker out of here, right? So I was definitely born into this environment, but it was really interesting that we joke about Top Gun and some folks saying that it was one of the largest tools,
recruitment
tools
for
the Navy.
Yeah, I think that they paid a lot, the military paid a lot of money into that movie.
That's what I was also hearing.
Yeah,
I haven't read up on it completely yet.
I think that there's a strong relationship between Hollywood and the military, and I feel pretty confident saying that's a fact, but I could definitely check it out myself.
That would be a great topic for, yeah, definitely, because yeah. I do think we do have plans to have one of our sessions be specifically over the recruitment work that we're doing, informed recruitment, and like really examining what that means, especially for children. Like myself, who saw the movie Top Gun when, say, I was like 6 years old, and I, you know, they did put a lot of money into it, and I see that the direct result was really even myself romanticizing it, and I, you know, would play Top Gun, right, as a kid, and I was always Maverick, and I told myself at 6 years old, I'm going to grow up, and I'm going to work with fighter jets, and fast forward 12 years later, and that's exactly what I did, was I was in air combat command and control, specifically working on live fire and simulated missions with fighter aircraft for aerial assault and aerial defense, as well as an instructor for the surveillance technician school. So it was really, it is a direct correlation.
Uh-huh. What was it like, you know, arriving at your dream and the reality of becoming those things and actually seeing that in the world and being part of that?
To be really honest, during that time, I was extremely filled with a lot of a sense of pride and accomplishment. I mean, I remember, you know, going off to boot camp, and this whole time my family celebrating me, right? It's interesting because my recruiter was there the entire way. My recruiter came to my birthday party, and my cake said "Happy Birthday, Airman," And it, you know, even my childhood wasn't necessarily mine because it was completely always stamped with the military label. But then, you know, when I went to boot camp and we had our field training and we carried around our gun and we, you know, crawled through the dirt and, you know, we just kind of went through hell and had people screaming at us. And, you know, so we really felt like we had really gone through something together and got a taste of what it really was and really proved how tough we were, mm-hmm. and that we were really proving our worth because we were really told that we had none until we proved ourselves. And so when I got my first coin, you know, my airman's coin, I remember, you know, even welling up in tears a little bit because I was like, now I'm somebody.
Wow, yeah. In the Navy, we had, it was like a song they played where, what was it? Proud to be an American, or is it cheesy, you know, and then everybody's crying and it's at the end of boot camp when they've completely broken you down. And then they're playing this cheesy song and you're watching all these people just bawl, and it's very surreal, right?
Right, and I think one of the interesting things about it is, you know, we're talking about this journey of, you know, what it is to grow up in a militaristic environment and to find your achievement through that, and then being able to examine the experience we've had through that. So I remember going through, say, boot camp, and it was, you know, 24/7, 25/7, right?
Yeah, 27/7.
Yes. And there was so little time to find any reprieve, and I think that there's this relationship, again, with the U.S. government and the U.S. military and colonialism also being deeply interwoven into Christianity. And so that was a religion that was made available to me in boot camp, and that was only that was also the only reprieve I could find, is if I had agreed to go to church on Sunday, I might get the opportunity to sit down for an hour, mm-hmm. and not be told what to do, to not be screamed at, and to ingest the only probably positive thing in the series of a few months. But what ended up happening was, I don't remember preaching at all, but what I distinctly remember is that in this huge church with airmen lined up, children lined up next to each other sitting down, was that they would play videos of murder, and they would play videos of bombings, and they would play videos of targets being hit, and then they would kind of weave in fireworks and really kind of flashy scenes of military aircraft, and then they would overlay that with songs like Proud to Be an American and such. And so what I would find myself doing was actually ingesting really violent propaganda in a church as I'm being processed into the military.
Wow. I, as a Navy photographer, worked a lot with that propaganda. I know what you're talking about, and it is like desensitization, just and even going back to those military movies that get played, where everybody has this idea of what it's going to be like because they've seen all these movies and TV, and then reality of it is so different.
So yeah, I don't think we think about the personal consequences about what's going on. I don't think we sit and listen enough to these stories and really affirm, you know, because it's traumatizing to hear, because it's traumatizing to talk about, but, you know, what are we doing as a society to hear these stories, ingest them, and affirm that, and then follow it up with what are we going to do together? And that's what I found in Veterans for Peace, and I think if I can use this platform to inspire the rehumanization that has happened, I've achieved something in my life that might be able to make up for what I was a part of.
Did you have any specific event that was a major turning point for your views, or where you sort of realized you needed to make amends or change your actions with life or, you know, serving in the military?
Actually, no. I think it was, as much as I was steadily built up over the years, it took almost the same dismantling over a series of years. But I do know that it was a stark reckoning that I had on active duty, because even though I was told that this was going to be the highest level that I could achieve, and I was even, you know, I think forced into this position because being First Nations, you know, my gender and my race, in the environment that I was in, I think that I've consistently been looked down on, and my experiences have been abusive and have been racist. And so in order for me to substantiate my identity and my gender, right, is to go through what I was told was, well, if you go into the military first thing, basically it'll shape me up into a decent human being who might be worth something in the civilian world. And so going from that mentality and seeing all these men actually in my family who served, none of them are women. And then contrasting that with how I was treated, nobody gave me the tips, tricks, or tools in how to survive or protect myself in the military. And as much as we say it's merit-based, it's absolutely not completely true. And so I think it was just kind of a rude awakening going into that system and saying it's not as glorious as they say it is, and not all of us are receiving the same privileges through this system. And it took me a while to process that over the next few years, because I think the first 2 years I went into where I was kind of in this silent zone between the military and the rest of the world.
Yeah, I felt like I was living a double life when I was in the military, and I almost had two different personalities, like whoever went and was in the military every day, and then whoever I was, which was an extremely different person when I got off work, and especially if I went home or traveled far away. So how did you get involved with Veterans for Peace?
You know, it took time. So kind of bridging off of, it was a process through the first couple of years. I was kind of in the silent zone. And then the next couple of years, it was kind of trying to get my bearings in the civilian world and learn new languages. And then it was, I had started college as like an older student.
Were you going on your GI Bill?
I was using my GI Bill. I really had no idea how to use it. When I left the military, they gave me a 4-hour briefing and told me, this is how you open a bank account. This is the paperwork that you need to do, and here's how long you have health insurance. So I really had no idea how to use it. I just walked into a school one day because I had really hit a wall with what I was supposed to do in life and wanted to find something else that was going to get me through, which is the medical field. But I realized that wasn't enough. That I was understimulated with a medical assisting certificate, and that I could just go pre-med. But what I found was there was veteran community. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where I had started the journey to Veterans for Peace and getting involved with. I had started up a Student Veterans of America chapter at my college, and that turned into finding needs and figuring out how to get creative in meeting some of those needs by peer support, by creating a scholarship and funding that, and then also kind of creating engaging events for other students who are veterans and struggling. So we'd, you know, go do kind of typical things that maybe veterans might like to do. We like went paintballing and you know, obstacle courses in the trees and stuff like that. And you know, eventually I found my own healing in therapy. And so I think through talking out things, I started finding people that I could have conversations with that I didn't have words for before. And
finding common ground with other people.
Yeah. And then I also found a lot of feelings through my anger in working with some of my combat brothers who, you know, went through the Army. And that was really my community for a while in a rural town was Army dudes. And through that work is actually how I got contracted as a federal contractor with the Army doing suicide prevention, is building on former stuff that I did. And between that anger that I felt and that protection for like fellow brothers and sisters who were infantry and doing a different type of combat than I did, right, and finding people who were like me, is that naturally kind of started navigating me towards you know, the anti-war movement.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine working with people that are struggling too. Also, like, I just imagine that it would be a little bit traumatic, and maybe surprisingly so. Doing suicide prevention work and listening to other people's stories and getting involved that way. I just can imagine that it sort of awoke things, and
Right. Yeah. It's really heavy work. And I think, again, part of this work is being able to rehumanize the experience of those who have endured war and stop looking at it like it's a Top Gun video. Stop looking at it like it's an Army of One commercial. Stop looking at it like Xbox games and jumpy houses that the recruiters bring in.
Right.
And so, working in doing suicide intervention work is where I started at 19 years old. And equipping people with the skills to meet someone at that crisis mode, but that's something you don't ever put that down. And so I feel like I've always served that role of being there for those 3 a.m. phone calls where people have lost touch with the ground and are really having trouble reconciling, just the same as I did, but in different ways. The guilt that we carry and the blood that's on our hands for somebody else's war, for somebody else's agenda, that we haven't been given the time and space to dissect when it comes to what white supremacy and colonialism and militarism like really is, and the consequences of that, not just on the people that we're harming, but ourselves too. And we need to look at it as a whole together global problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're wrapping up here, and I just want to know if there's anything you have to say for our listeners about connecting with the local chapter or with you.
Right, yeah, I would say, I hope something that I have said resonates with you or somebody that you do know, and, it might feel like a big step to reach out to the chapter using, either our website or our Facebook or even our Twitter. Or direct email, which all of those things are online if you want to go out there and find them. But I promise you that there's people on the other end who are, excited to meet you and excited to talk to you and ready to meet you or who you know where they're at, because this work is really meaningful. And we have another spike in violent militaristic actions going on right now is, we're seeing what's going on with Iran and as hard as it is to talk about this stuff right now, it's that I want to make sure people know that if there is anybody extremely qualified to speak on war, it's those who have survived and come back from it and are able to tell the tales of why this type of work is important and why we need to do the things that Veterans for Peace really does. And all the information is online. And so find something that works for you. Find something that calls to you. And come wherever you are. Come however you can. Because we're here to meet you.
We're building a movement. We need you. Well, thank you so much for coming, and hopefully we'll have you again soon.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks so much for having me and doing this work, and really, really grateful for what you also bring as a member of Veterans for Peace, and I appreciate you a lot.
Thanks.
Thank you, Faraz, for being on the show today. I greatly appreciate it. So recently, the U.S. and Iran came close to war. When I say came close to war, a shooting war. And there have been several times when it looked like the two would resort to open warfare over the past, 30 plus years.
Yes.
Now, you and I have marched many times against the U.S. Going to war. And in the summer of 2013, you and I, along with Michael Kramer, a veteran of the Israel Defense Forces, we did a few presentations to try to educate people about the possibility of U.S. wars with Iran and why. So now here we are again, 7 years, almost 7 years later, continuing to resist these wars and talk about what the real reasons are behind them. But before we talk about this, the U.S. and Iran possibly escalating to more open warfare, can you tell us briefly a little bit about yourself? For example, you're a member of Veterans for Peace USA, but you served in the Iranian military. So what brought you to the U.S. and why did you join Veterans for Peace?
Yes, let me start from Iran. In Iran, military service is mandatory. Was mandatory and still is. you have to do your service either after you graduate from high school, or they allow you to continue on to college. You can do it after you finish your college, and regardless how far you go. So if you go all the way to PhD, then you have to take it there. I got my bachelor's degree in Iran, and I was not planning to stay for continuing my education. So I had to do my military service before I left for my graduate work in the US. So I did my military service after I finished my bachelor's degree. And then came to the United States, went to Southern Illinois University, SIU, that's where I got my master's and PhD there. I was involved from the beginning, as soon as I came, in the student demonstrations against the Shah of Iran, which was massive all over the country, everywhere. Confederation of Iranian Students were organizing that. So that is how I started in the U.S., in the Iranian student activities against the U.S. and the Shah of Iran. And that developed into my contacts with various organizations, including U.S. Peace Council, which I've been a member of for more than 40 years. And it was through these activities that, in fact, I met David Klein. It was, I think, late 80s, somewhere around there in Jersey City, in New Jersey.
Can you tell people real quickly who David Klein was?
Anyway, at the time, he was the president of Veterans for Peace, and he was the president of the chapter that we both belonged to afterwards in New Jersey. We were working together against war, this and that, and for several years, actually. And it was David who, he was one of my dearest and closest comrades throughout all this time. And he said, why did you join, if you did military service in Iran, why didn't you join Veterans for Peace? So I would love to, but I thought you had to be a veteran of the United States military. He said, no. Bylaws allows that. So that's why I gladly joined the Veterans for Peace and became a member of Chapter 21, and I'm still a member of Chapter 21.
Okay.
And I have the honor of being the chair of Iran Working Group of Veterans for Peace. So,
great. Well, thank you. Thank you. Sure. Thank you for all your work. So the U.S. and Iran have been at odds with each other for quite some time.
Correct.
But things have escalated over the past, I guess, 3 years. Could you tell us a little bit about how you see this escalation that has led to what almost became a shooting war last week, or the beginning of the year?
Well, I would go further, and I say the escalation began with George W. Bush when he put Iran and Korea and I think one other country on the axis of evil.
Yes.
And called for overthrow of Iran and
Iraq.
That's how it started.
Iran, Iraq, and North Korea.
Yes. And that's how it started. Of course, Obama tried to kind of moderate it a little bit, tried to come to some diplomatic terms and agreements. But it was clear that the U.S. establishment does not consider the possibility, or it does not agree with the possibility of Iranian government remaining as a force of resistance in the Middle East. They have to either change the government to make it come back to the U.S. fold, or to crush the whole place. And you know, they have done it. Saddam Hussein was an ally of the United States during the Iran-Iraq War. U.S. supported him for 8 years. In the war, provided logistic information, intelligence, and through Saudi Arabia, they funded the war against Iran to the point that they provided him with the chemical weapons that he attacked Iran with, Iranian forces. So the animosity has been there since the beginning of the revolution in Iran, and has been continuing up and down through time. But with the question of the Iraqi government, Saddam Hussein, who was an ally of the United States, then became a persona non grata that had to be removed. And after the invasion of Iraq by the United States, which weakened the country as a rival of Iran, it increased the Iranian influence in the region. Iran began to have more say in what is going on. And this really threatened Israelis, definitely. They felt scared that Iran might gain enough strength to block the processes, because Iran immediately started to, as soon as the revolution came, Iran, you know, closed down Israeli embassy and turned it over to PLO, closed down the South African embassy and turned it into ANC, handed over to ANC. Iran moved out of the military pacts that the Shah had with the United States and joined the non-aligned movement, expelled all the U.S. oil companies and European oil companies from the country, expelled 60,000 U.S. military advisors and military personnel from Iran. So U.S. was looking for an opportunity to find a reason to get back at Iran. And with Iran's increasing influence, and especially after the U.S. attempt to overthrow Syria was frustrated with the help of Iran and later Russia, and a creation of a kind of axis of resistance against U.S. domination in the region, consisting of Iran, Iraq, Iraq kind of half-hearted in the middle, but still there, resistance was there, although the government was kind of set up by the United States, but Iraqi government has gradually become closer to Iran. Hezbollah of Lebanon and Russia and China, it became into a bloc resisting U.S. domination and plans in the region, and that's why they decided that they have to do something about it. They felt threatened by this, especially since Russia and China came to the support of Iran and Syria. So they're afraid of that front, and that's why they escalated to kind of put an end to this coalition that has emerged as a result of these struggles. Since, I would say, 2011, when the whole thing in Syria started and Iran started helping Syrian government.
Okay. So you said a lot. And there's a lot of history in what you just said. So one thing, you spoke about the revolution, the Iranian revolution in 1979, is what you were speaking specifically about. We could go back to when Mossadegh was the prime minister of Iran.
Yes.
Because you talked about the tensions starting around 79 because of the revolution, but that might be, I guess, the way I might look at it, or the way I see it, is tensions within the U.S. public, looking at Iran as some kind of enemy, probably started in 79. I know when I was a kid, because in 79, I was 15 in high school, I believe, I was upset about Iran taking U.S. hostages. You know, I didn't understand the full picture. But I also, just to say, I had a little bit of political sense, because at the same time, looking at the news and thinking about, I didn't know that the U.S. had helped overthrow their democratically elected prime minister, I believe in 1953. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Most of that.
August 53.
So before I go back to the revolution, I would say that tensions, at least for the Iranians, began with the U.S. then.
Not only that, it's not just the coup, but it's also what happened for the next 25 years with the Shah of Iran as a very savage dictator, supported by the United States, suppressing every civil rights, every freedom of speech, every you know, freedom of assembly. No political party was allowed. No union was allowed. Nothing. And whoever resisted that was labeled as communist and put in prison and tortured. I mean, the number of people killed under the Shah. So it wasn't just a coup in 53 that people could forget 5 years after. It was a continuous process of torture, killing, and repression until 79, when people were fed up completely and decided that they have to do something. So it the Iranian hurt, I would call it, was not just one-shot coup. It was a continuous process until 79, when the revolution happened. And the one thing, I don't know if people know about this, but it wasn't the Iranian government taking hostages, you know. It was the Iranian students in Tehran University. And the reason for it, I don't know how many people know, but the U.S., Iran foreign minister, after the revolution, secretly met with U.S. authorities. I think it was in Cyprus, I'm not sure. And they were arranging to bring the Shah, who was diagnosed with cancer, to the United States, the deposed Shah. And this information was leaked by a newspaper in Beirut, that there was such a secret meeting and there is an agreement by the United States to take the Shah in there, in the United States, in the name of, you know, giving him medical care. But the Iranian government and the whole revolutionary people, leadership, was afraid that this is just a cover to use the Shah from the United States to stage a counter-revolution. And, you know, given the fact that it was immediately after the revolution and the Iranian government, the new government, was not really in charge of anything, and the military was still in the hand of the United States, and all those things, this could easily happen. So the Iranian government opposed it, and when it was leaked that there was this secret meeting, Khomeini said one thing that I think triggered the whole process, but he wasn't ordering a takeover. What he said was that shame on a revolutionary government whose leaders meet with Satan secretly. And that was all he said about it. And the following day, the students on their own took over the embassy. And it really surprised both United States and Iran, because they didn't want to get to that level of confrontation with the U.S. that early on, or even maybe they didn't even want it, because they were not in a position to challenge the United States like that.
Right, right.
So they were, you know, kind of inviting aggression against themselves by doing that.
Right.
And the Iranian government, you know, neither side wanted to flinch afterwards. So it dragged on for 444 days, but... you know, if people don't understand what happened and that the fact that the Iranian government, it wasn't the Iranian government or leadership that did that.
Right.
They were stuck with the situation.
Yeah, and that's a very important distinction, as you said, and I should remember, I will remember to make that distinction. And I was reading about it again, I think last night, and it said the Iranian students took the hostages, what I was reading. So that's an important distinction.
But we should also know that immediately after they went into the embassy, they let women and African Americans leave.
Yes. Right. In a show of solidarity.
Right, exactly.
Yes. So as I was saying, in Iran, these tensions with the U.S. had been going on since at least 1953, with a growing sentiment because of the repression by the Shah.
Right.
But here in the United States, and you know, I was only born in 64, so what do I really know? But I imagine that most people were not paying attention, so they had no idea of what the foreign policy was doing, just like today.
Yes.
But once things exploded out in the open in the revolution, and the rhetoric towards the U.S., which was fair rhetoric, that our government's not going to explain, you know, in the news, unfortunately, it's not going to explain like you just did, so that the American public can say, oh, I shouldn't be upset with the Iranian government or the people. I understand what's happening. So I think that was the beginning of demonizing Iran. And it set up, I guess, very fertile soil for that demonization, because people always harken back to that.
Yes.
And since 1979 to today, the propaganda and disinformation that comes out about Iran is really rooted in that 79 revolution and the taking.
That's true. And also, if you look at it historically, every time tensions grow between Iran and the U.S., one more time, the video about the hostage crisis starts being shown all over the place.
Right.
To get people back into that kind of a
mindset,
mentality.
Yes.
Mind.
Right. And I think what I want the listeners to try to understand is that the beginning of these tensions really began with U.S. and U.K. interference in domestic politics in Iran.
Definitely.
And one of the things you talked about earlier was how after the revolution and the new government, they threw out the oil executives and the oil companies. And that's exactly what got Mossadegh overthrown, or what, I shouldn't say that. That's why, I shouldn't say it that way. That's why the US and UK, these European powers, set out and created this coup within Iran and used the Shah as their ally and put in, he was already in power as the monarchy, but he didn't have real political power.
Yes, that's true. That's exactly after World War II, his father sided with Germany. Mm. Although he was brought to power in 1901, I think. 1921, by the British through a coup.
Right.
But he sided in World War II with Germans. And that's why after the war, they decided to remove him close to the end of the war and installed his young son, who didn't know anything about politics. He was a kind of playboy living in Switzerland. Okay. They brought him back and put him in charge. But the whole Iranian society was, at that time, probably a period of 4 or 5 years, was really open. Lots of political parties and everything before the coup. So he was not really in charge. He was a ceremonial figure there.
Right, right.
But after the coup, he really, with the help of the United States, created that SAVAK, the secret service that did right. all it that.
Took over.
Yeah, he was trained by the CIA, that's their service, and the Mossad of Israel, the torture chamber, the methods right. and all those. And
so they had a, people should understand that the government was democratically elected.
Yes.
And because they nationalized natural resources, in particular oil, mm-hmm. that the UK and the United States, the Western powers, didn't like that. So they orchestrated this coup mm-hmm. in 1953. So when we talk about how this all started, is I think it's very important to understand that it's all started because the United States and our allies interfered in domestic politics and overthrew a country's democratically elected government. And we keep talking about democracy, but yet we usurp democracy in that nation. And so here we are today. This is the aftermath and the legacy of what the United States did in Iran. Now, I'm not trying to make any excuses for Iranian government actions, and I'm not—
Me neither.
Right. I'm not a fan of anybody's government. So right. I'm not sure. Trying, but at the same time, we have to understand how things begin, mm-hmm. you know, so that then that provides us a path to how to address issues when we're dealing with facts and the truth, right?
That's true.
So what else before we only have like 2 more minutes before we wrap this up? So what do you think we need to do going forward?
Well, first of all, there is a international day of action on the 25th of January, which has been organized by a lot of organizations, including ourselves.
Yourselves meaning Veterans for Peace?
Veterans for Peace is involved also.
Yeah.
And Peace Council and UNEC and dozens of other organizations that are organizing this. There's going to be days of protests around 70, 80 cities in the United States are already organizing. They are, there's a kind of list, if you want to, I can send it to you.
Okay.
For the country, for the cities that are in, and we are trying to organize as many cities in other countries. All right, somebody from Portugal contacted me that they're doing something there in Lisbon.
Great.
So there's a lot happening about that. The fact is, my feeling is that neither United States nor Iran want a really a fighting war with troops. But it doesn't mean the war is not going to go on. Because war, I mean, invasions and directed deployment is one form. Now, with the economy in shambles and U.S. economy not being able to support another big war, they are resorting to drone wars. They're resorting to coup attempts. They're resorting to assassination attempts, as example that you saw. And they are resorting to using economic sanctions as a weapon of war. Because statistically, U.S. sanctions have killed more than U.S. wars since World War II. And the difference is that when you deploy, it's one day it's happening and people can protest against it, right? But when you impose a sanction, it's done silently. People don't see it. They don't understand what is going on. But you shut down the medicine, food, electricity, trade, all of that, banking system. Iran cannot receive money for its oil anymore, same as Venezuela and others. The banking system is shut down in front of them. So they have to pay cash. Where do you get the cash for that?
Right.
Billions of dollars. So anyway, this sanction method, economic sanction method, has become the weapon of choice now. Because that doesn't trigger any response by the public either.
Right.
So they're doing it. And now, as you heard, they're increasing the sanctions on Iran again after this incident. So they're going that route. And war by they're taking that route of sanctions and war by proxy also, rather than going directly. And again, unfortunately, the attitude is that people's annoyance with the U.S. policy somehow is related to the number of bodies that come back. And if you can do it with drones, by somebody sitting right in Denver and doing it, they know it's not going to anger people that much, as opposed when Americans get killed.
Right.
So they're coming to all these alternative methods of, you know, carrying out the same war by different means. And this is going to go on. This is going to go on.
Right.
No question about it.
Right. All right, Faraz. Well, thank you so much. I want to have you back to talk about this more, especially the sanctions. I think that's the very important. I guess we should talk even broader, just war by other means, you know, and talk about that. So once again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah.
The music you hear is by The Passion Hi-Fi. You can find this music or his music at www.thepassionhifi.com.
Thanks again for tuning into Seattle Veterans for Peace Radio Hour. You can stay informed about what the local chapter is up to on our Facebook page. We're Seattle Chapter 92. You can also check us out at www.veteransforpeace.org. That's our national website. And our local chapter is www.vfp92.org. Next month, we'll be broadcasting at 6 p.m. on the 26th of February. If you want to join us then, that would be great. More importantly, we are having an anti-war rally the 25th of January here in Seattle. It's going to be at 1:15 p.m. at Westlake Park, and that should be a pretty big event where you can connect with not only Veterans for Peace, but Answer Coalition and a lot of other great organizations that are working together to do anything to end the war.
Right, and it's a national day of action, so it'll be connected to demonstrations taking place around the country, and actually in some places, in different places around the world.
Great, thanks.
Yeah.
So those interviews were really intense. Do you have any final thoughts about your interview, especially? I'm like, wow.
Yeah. Well, let me talk a little bit about the one with Phoenix. I'm a Christian, and when I say that, I'm probably a person who would be put out of the church based on my beliefs, because they're not necessarily go along with what what supposedly, I guess, is the right thinking. However, when she was talking about being in boot camp and going to church, and instead of hearing preaching, which is fine, of course, that's probably a good thing. But instead, though, seeing films of bombs being dropped and people being killed, and then they're playing this patriotic music and playing Proud to Be an American, that's pretty disgusting. I mean, I was there with y'all doing the interview, and I was getting very upset. And I can't tell you how upset I was getting. I had to calm myself down. And honestly, that's one of the problems we have in our country is that people don't really live up to principles. And I'm not trying to say, I mean, I'm not perfect. I do things. I'm a sinner. And it's one thing that as a Christian, everyone sins. However, you're supposed to really try really, really hard, to do the right thing. And some things is obvious. And that right there is one of the most disgusting things that I've heard about the church. And I don't know. I don't even know what to say. If there's people out there that have a similar story, I would be very interested in knowing about that. Even if there's some way that we could hold people accountable, because just on a Christian level, I would have been disgusted. But let's say if you're not a Christian, or if you're Muslim or whatever, and you're getting exposed to these kind of things, that just shouldn't be happening. So that really stuck out for me.
Definitely.
Yeah.
As just someone who worked in media in the military, it stuck out to me too. Just it's a propaganda machine, right? And they kind of put it in anywhere. And also points to a lot of the confusion that's going on, that people aren't, maybe they're definitely not in the right spirit, but maybe not even in the right mind when stuff like that's going on. And definitely not connected in the way that, as you said, like a Christian should be, or that people claim that faith is.
Right. Yeah. Another thing you all talked about was, Top Gun came up, and how Phoenix, when she saw Top Gun, that made her think about going in the military, and she visioned herself as working with planes and such, and that's what happened. Mm-hmm. So we talked a little bit about how Top Gun impacted American society, and I looked up, I think I sent you an article about Top Gun.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you have any comments about that. They spent millions of dollars to help make Top Gun. And
I do, just again, as someone who worked in the media and the military, and I was in the Navy. And so you could see Top Gun and then join the Navy and know how very different it is. And it's a ridiculous film. It's nothing like your Navy experience. Everybody that's been in the Navy can say that.
Right.
But also the relationship between Hollywood and the military.
Right.
And even on Navy ships, we would get movies released to us ahead of time. I know the military has contracts with Hollywood, and that is a big part of the propaganda machine, is to, feed people these narratives that make war look glorious and make it, tidy, and there's heroes, and anybody that's been there knows that that's not true. But it's a little too late when you're already there to find that out.
Well, and I think another example most recently is the Captain Marvel movie, where we have the female warrior is the protagonist. And similar to Top Gun, they show her flying her planes, and they show these other women, strong women. But that's, once again, propaganda to kind of get women to want to to join, and also to show that the military isn't sexist, where we know it is. And we also know that I think it's like a third of the women who join the military face sexual harassment and sexual assault. Of course, that movie didn't show any of that. So these are the kind of things that, listeners, we want you to watch out for, because it's like a jiu-jitsu move that they try to put on our minds.
That violence is the answer to everything, and you're a hero by doing violence to solve your problems.
Right.
And I mean, we're living in a country where our children are going out and shooting each other en masse, and it's just become normal. But this military culture is definitely the influence, and the desensitization, it's really real. And and people are waking up, but it's kind of astonishing. Like, what is it going to take to get people to really stand up and do something?
Yeah, that's true. I do want to say, though, that I think part of the problem is that it's hard for people to see a path to peace. And one of the things I talk about within the peace movement is that we have to work at peace at home, peace abroad. It can't just be that we want people to look at what's happening in foreign lands when in their own neighborhoods, they don't feel like it's peaceful. So it's not one or the other. Dr. King talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to be able to envision it and work on it at home to even be able to imagine that with a person, I don't speak their language. It might be a different religion, different culture. I can't even be peaceful with this guy who lives next door, you know? So part of the problem, I think, is that, and it's really it works for the system, you know, because they want to keep us divided. So as much as that, as long as they can keep us going at each other,
mm-hmm.
And having the mindset of violence like you're talking about, then we're willing to use it in other places because, hey, this is the way it works. That's what people think. This is the real world.
It's true. And it makes me think of just lately, there's so many different narratives of apocalypse and it's the end of the world and war and it's terrifying.
Yes.
And a lot of this seems so real, but we're still in a place where we are telling ourselves stories and we can tell other stories. We can use our imaginations to tell different narratives and make different movies even. And I think that has a lot of power in changing how we feel and how we think. And it maybe it's a small start, but I think that it's true that the things that we ingest, the images, the words, anything can make our minds think something's normal.
Right.
And so if we start telling more peaceful narratives and that we can solve our problems without violence, and that's actual strength, not, you know, violence is weakness.
Yes.
It's the simplest, most basic part of our brain. It goes right back to primitive animals.
Right. Right.
And allegedly we're beyond that, but obviously we're not.
You know, Laura, you said maybe it's a small step, but I believe that we all think in narratives, you know, and we process information based on a narrative that we're thinking in already. So it's really, I think, the most powerful way to create change. And many people today are talking about, and I really believe that the progressives, the left or whatever, we need to develop positive narratives. The people who are opposition, I don't want to call them our enemy, they have a narrative, and it feeds into a lot of the basic things that you're talking about. So it goes along with that. And what we're asking people to do is develop narratives that like they say, to our better angels or to the better part of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And we really need to work on that, and we need to live it, you know, because I know a lot of people on the right look at it and say, well, y'all not that different from us, but we're acting, we're talking different mm-hmm. rhetoric, but are we acting?
Right.
You know,
at the end of the day, it's all the same.
Right.
You can look at each team and I have on the internet and they're all saying the same.
Right.
And they're not focused on the real problems.
Right. So we have to live it, a new narrative that we're living. You know, so I think that's really important.
I absolutely agree. All right, looks like we got to wrap up. And thanks again for listening. And join us again next month on the 26th